Interesting situation. Williams throwing near the poach, but it's Babbitt beating Musa Jah to the spot, and New York's back in front. 29 seconds left.
I don't need to be able to read lips to know that he just told us that he owns that front cone. He has been unbelievable tonight getting to this spot.
Welcome back. It's Swing Pass season end award time. It's time to hand out some hardware from a hard-won 2023 season. Of course, New York Empire are going to get their slew of accolades after their second consecutive perfect season in 2023. But there are awards to be handed out all over the league. I am Adam Ruffner. I'm joined, as always, by Daniel Cohen. We're going to get right into it because this is going to be a jam-packed episode talking about the best players from the 2023 season. And we want to get to the individual awards at first, but there are a slew of teams to go look at the AUDL.com. Full of all the information for the first team, second team, third team in the AUDL, the defensive teams, the rookie of the year teams, as well as these individual awards, which we will get to, starting with the 2023 league MVP. Who else but the big man himself from New York Empire, Jeff Babbitt. He led the league in goals this year. He also felt like he led the league in emphatic moments. It was a season filled with flexes and ferocious screams from number 87 on the Empire. He just kind of felt like the force churning at the center of all the season's momentum and the Empire's perfect season. Babbitt, of course, not the only member of the Empire to take home individual honors from the 2023 season. Antoine Davis being named the league's top defender, taking home Defensive Player of the Year honors for his stellar play, locking down some of the top options in the entire AUDL, particularly for his white-hot second half of the 2023 season. He gets his first all-defense nod as well. Rookie of the Year award going to who else but the stellar defender out in LA, the Aviators' own Lucas Ambrose, has been exploding out of a cannon for that team all season. Really the spark plug at the center of LA's kind of turnaround after they began 2023 1-3, the Aviators, of course, finishing by knocking off Colorado in the first round of the playoffs and then advancing to the franchise's only second West Division championship game appearance. Other individual awards include two Salt Lake Shred members who will get some high honors. First, most improved award going to Jace Dunabile, the stellar combo receiver thrower for that Shred offense. He finished last season in the bottom half of his own team's offensive rotation in goals scored. He finishes 2023 as the team's leading goal scorer for the number one offense in the AUDL. Just a remarkable improvement for Dunabile in 2023. And then, of course, the signal caller, the head honcho for the Shred team all season, head coach Bryce Merrill, taking home Coach of the Year honors. He leads that squad to an 11-1 record during the regular season. The only two losses the Shred endured in 2023 came at the hands of the Empire, once during the regular season and once in the 2023 AUDL championship game. So huge hats off to Merrill and all of his staff for making the Shred team not only so exciting in 2022 and 2023, but really kind of making them a cornerstone franchise in just 2 years of existence in the AUDL. The Shred have nothing but higher aspirations to climb to out in Utah. Daniel, this felt like one of the more rigorous and I think challenging ballot processes. We'll get to all the teams in a bit, but even these individual awards, I know you were going back and forth. I felt like I flipped a few times. We end up with Babbitt for MVP, which is who we all had unanimously at the midseason mark. But the final selections were anything from unanimous. Obviously, Babbitt missing some time in the East Division Championship game with those concussive symptoms, keeping on the sideline. And New York playing the best game ever, maybe in their four turnover performance against DC. So it threw some questions and some quirks into the voting process. Most improved player, I think, could have came down to 15 different candidates. Oh, Coach of the Year, too. I mean, Merrill wins it very deservingly. Steven Nagy, Charlie Hoppus, and Anthony Nunez also getting honor roll mentions. But you can go a few coaches beyond that. We've talked about Tuba Benson Jaja and all the work he's done in Atlanta and improving that team. I think you got to talk about somebody like Drew Shepherd in Indianapolis and what they're building with that young roster and kind of the quiet turnover that they've been going through the past couple of seasons. There's just so many deserving candidates. Defensive Player of the Year. We could spend an entire episode there, just you and I. But yeah. I wanted to ask you, where were kind of your hardship points in this whole process? I feel like we got to a very good conclusion with where things are. Again, you can go to the AUDL.com website, check out the full results for all the individual awards as well as the team nominations. But this was arduous, man. Like, this was a toughie.
It took me so long. I flip-flopped so many times on, like, most of the awards. Especially, I mean, we added a third team All-AUDL, too, which was just, you know, giving that many more players some recognition. But then deciding between that and second team was a whole thing. I think this was by far the toughest time I've had, just from top to bottom. Individual awards, team awards. I think that MVP, it was so funny, like throughout the season, like you said, Babbitt at the mid-season point was like pretty clearly the guy. And I feel like everyone was on the same page about that. He was definitely more quietly dominant the second half of the season. And so then I was just like, I was starting to think about other candidates like Jordan Kerr, Ryan Osgar were sort of towards the top of my ballot there. And then when championship weekend was coming, I was like, okay, this is it. This is the time where like someone's going to separate from the other guys, right? Like someone is going to have absolutely like season defining performances. And of course, Kerr was fantastic in that semifinal game, but then super quiet in the championship game. And then Osgar was like his usual good self, but nothing like so flashy. And Babbitt got moved to D-line and he was like a goal scoring machine on D-line, but didn't really have any huge defensive plays. I think if I got like one or two huge defensive highlights from Babbitt, that would have made him a clear-cut MVP choice, but I didn't really get any of that championship weekend. So I kept waiting for like more and more data points and I just wasn't getting them. So it made it extremely difficult. So many contenders for really all of the awards this year. And like you said, I am very happy with how everything turned out despite the struggle of actually picking guys to win.
And we'll get to that struggle when we start talking about the teams, because like you say, there was for the first time a third team All-AUDL. There's two defensive teams for the first time. We just had one All-Defense team last year and the year before. There's two rookie teams we continue to add in crop after crop, year after year, of some of the most impressive talents world over. There were so many deserving people who got left off those rookie teams, let alone these other teams. I mean, it just feels like there's starting to be this swelling of talent, right? I mean, you look like at teams like Atlanta and the Carolina Flyers, you know, these kind of preeminent teams we think of in our heads, they have maybe one, two names on some of these rosters for the All-AUDL mentions and honorable mentions. I mean, that feels like in itself a snub, let alone the individual snubs that exist elsewhere in this league. There are whole teams that could kind of claim a little bit more occupancy on some of these lists, I feel like, with how their players perform and their overall records and everything. Philadelphia, another one of those teams. I know they missed the playoffs this year, but again, just loaded with star talent on both lines. It just feels like we're getting to this point where each year going forward, there's going to be harder and harder decisions. It felt like a few years ago, there was a pretty clear consensus about who the top 14, 21 players were in any given season. 2023, not so much. And again, we'll get to more of that later when we talk about the All-AUDL teams. But for now, let's kind of try to contextualize the MVP, Babbitt, right? Like 2023, you say in the back half of the season, it felt like he didn't quite have the fire that he did in that first half, right? And I tend to agree with you. You know, we get week three, we get that game versus DC.
There were some signature performances early on. Like it was incredible to watch him in that DC game in particular.
Seven goals, three blocks, the defining moment of the entire game in a contest absolutely jam-packed with big moments is Babbitt streaking to that front cone and just erupting, who can even effing stop me right now? And it's just, I think that audio, that moment for me, in conjunction with everything else that he accomplished for the season, encapsulated why he was MVP. It was just there was a force multiplier, there was a momentum, there was this downhillness to Babbitt all season long where it felt like in any given one-on-one matchup, he was unstoppable. And I feel like the whole league knew that. And even going into championship weekend when it was questionable as to whether he would even play, when he does suit up, when he just does don the Empire black, white, and neon green, it feels like they add a Hulk level persona to their roster. Even if he is only scoring these kind of five-yard clap catch goals, even if he is shifting over the defense after leading the league in scoring all year long, you know, suddenly displacing his role and becoming a little bit more of a cog, I feel like, in the grander machine of that Empire D-line. And yet, for all of that, I still feel like his presence, his just that yelling, intimidation, size factor that he brings to every single point he's on the field for, that encapsulated so much of what the Empire were this season, where they were just head and shoulders better than the rest. And no other player personified that more front to back than Babbitt. In the back half, I think you can make a pretty good case for Antoine being kind of the co-MVP, given how he played. Ben Yacht, too. I mean, his huge performance in that East Division final, his ability to go back and forth, seemingly at will between offense and defense, making it look so easy guarding the number one option on opposing teams and becoming the number one option for his own team. Like, there are a lot of players, as we spent all season talking about with New York, that dude named Ryan Osgar, who you mentioned, he's pretty good, it turns out, at throwing the disc. But at the end of it all, it felt like it was just the Babbitt year. It felt like this was the year that's kind of been approaching for a few now. And another thing that we don't talk enough about Babbitt is that he's quietly struggled with injuries. The past couple of seasons, he's been sidelined. He's been hampered by injuries that kind of occlude his true ceiling. And you could just see it at times. Right. He came back from 2021, I think, with an added level of muscle that was almost unnecessary for Ultimate. And he lacked a little bit of steps. He was recovering from a hamstring injury at times during the 2021 season. He still made outrageous plays and numerous times throughout that season, but it wasn't quite the same in 2022 as well. He had hamstring injuries persisting throughout the year. He made some incredible plays at championship weekend, but he was clearly banged up. I believe he even went out of the championship game for a little bit following the third quarter buzzer beater against Chicago. It felt like he was a little bit more touch and go. And this year, up until he got that concussive symptom, I believe in week 13 against Montreal, somewhere around there, it was the full unleashing. It was the we can go to that guy at any time and collect basically five goals a game if we so choose. And every single time New York is going to work down into the red zone, it's basically Jaws music playing until they find Babbitt streaking towards an open cone. And just the effectiveness and the simplicity that New York was able to boil so much of offensive concepts down to, where it's just kind of A to B connections, just finding the big man and getting it to him. That sort of, again, simplicity, making things look so easy, that's kind of what carried it for me as far as Babbitt. There's something to be said about, I think, obviously, the statistical accomplishments of what he did, again, leading the league in goals, getting damn near 3,000 yards receiving, being a part of just any kind of lineup that he's available in and contributing an offensive efficiency that is kind of unmatched. And yet at the same time, it's kind of that aesthetic thing, right? Like that screaming that he owns it, right?
Well, and I feel like championship weekend really brought that whole thing home because, they shifted him to defense. It was kind of paralleled with what happened last year with Osgar, where he was just like in this primary throwing role all year. Like, that's why he was going to win MVP. And then based on how defenses were playing him in the playoffs and at championship weekend, he turned into this like downfield goal scoring threat. Similarly, like in terms of a role shift, Babbitt played D-line, but it was like, it was the same exact thing, and maybe even more so when that D-line got into the red zone. And the D-line had a lot of possessions at championship weekend, which helped. Like, it helped Babbitt continue to shine in that same role. But, like, it's so clear. It's so obvious. Everyone's just waiting. They're just, like, they're swinging the disc. They're buying time until there's that Babbitt cut. and he's breaking free in the end zone. Like no one feels any need to switch the game plan around or to take any other shot rather than the shot to Babbitt at the front cone. And the fact that he moved to D-line and again was just like the guy that is going to score goals, it's incredible that he just carries that role no matter where he's playing. And everyone knows it, both offensively and defensively, and no one can do anything about it. So it was like one of the most unstoppable goal-scoring years that I've witnessed, at least in my time following the league. I wasn't around for like the early Cam Brock goal-scoring explosions, but yeah, I don't know. I feel like this has to rank right up there with those.
I mean, pre-modern AUDL is kind of like a different sport altogether. So
yeah,
I don't know,
it's hard to compare.
Step on that scale right now, but I do want to pose the question of kind of where does this Babbitt MVP season stack up, right? Like this is the now fourth straight season that a New York Empire player has won. 2019 to 2021, Ruben Yat. 2022, Ryan Osgar. 2023, Jeff Babbitt. 2018, Rowan McDonald. 2017, John Nethercutt. 2016, Dylan Tanell. 15-14, Bo Kittredge. 13-12, Goose Helton. Among the compendium of AUDL MVPs to this point in the league's history, where do you kind of put this Babbitt season? Because I feel like it's one of the hardest to qualify because, again, when you think of pre-modern AUDL, you go back and you look at those first couple of Goose and Bo MVP stat lines. They're basically putting up 30-30-30 seasons. Like they're just collecting user-controlled video game number stat lines. And it's a little bit out of focus as to like what those mean. And you look at something like 2023 Babbitt, who has these incredible goals and blocks numbers and kind of this almost storytelling aesthetic to his candidacy that I think really encapsulates how powerful, how dominant he was in 2023. But then you look at something like he has two assists in some of the overall yardage numbers and just usage stats pale in comparison to like a 2018 Rowan or even a 2017 Nethercutt, who was almost leading the league in assists through 72 assists that year and was just bombing it from everywhere, you know, peak nut. Where does this Babbitt kind of slot in your head? Because I think I have an answer, but I would love to hear yours first.
I mean, it's by far the most unique MVP season we've had, right? Like every single MVP before Babbitt has had some element of being an incredible thrower and getting and being an incredible scorer in general in their ability to both throw and catch goals in the end zone. We've never had it where it was really like the goal scoring and the defense, and maybe you throw in buzzer beater ability in that mix that really led Babbitt to winning this award. But like you said, it is like it's a testament to how dominant he was at those things that he was even in the conversation for MVP, right? Like I still think in ultimate throwing is like the most impressive and most difficult skill to like master. So in terms of like, you know, the best MVP seasons, I'm always going to put the throwing seasons up there towards the top. And so I feel like Babbitt is just naturally gonna fall down for me behind seasons that Osgar had and probably that Yacht had as well and Rowan too. But at the same time, there is like there's an amount of certainty you get with Babbitt and like mistake-free ultimate too. Like his completion rate is probably towards the top of any MVP we've ever had. I think Osgar was the previous guy to be the first MVP that had higher than like a 93% completion percentage for the entire season. Babbitt, of course, is up there too. You know, not a thrower, so it means something different. But like that ability he has and the fact that he never had like a bad game, there was never a solution that any team came up with to stop him. Whereas like the Yacht seasons, he'd have like random like 4 to 5 throwaway games sprinkled in here and there. So it really is like a difference. It's hard to really judge Babbitt against these other ones. But to answer your original question, I'm still going to put the throwers pretty much all ahead of Babbitt. I probably put Babbitt ahead of like the old, I don't know, Goose and Kittredge seasons, even though this was just before my time and I wasn't witnessing those live. But yeah, I don't know. Where's your head at?
don't know. It's so tough, man. Like, again, I think everything kind of 2017 and before is a bit of a pre-modern AUDL. It feels like in those seasons, turnovers weren't quite taken as critically. There wasn't sort of this possession meta that there is now in modern AUDL, kind of 2018 to present. And so, yeah, I'm a little bit more, I think, encumbered in moving some of those early dudes up in my ladder. And yet, when we talk about this stuff, about MVP, about who kind of represent the season, so to speak, I do reflect on how dominant Goose was in 2013, how dominant Bo was in 2014 in particular. You know, these are players who manifested on both sides of the disc and could kind of win whatever scenario they were in at a time when the game wasn't connecting passes, wasn't possession. It was winning these kind of hero ball situations. And I think that having a Goose, having a Bo, having even kind of like a Rowan, I mean, I would almost extend it a little bit into 2018. I think in 2018, you saw a changing during the season. But, you know, I think about like the 2018 semifinals between New York and Dallas. It was just like a 32-30 huck fest. And it just felt like turnovers were kind of to be damned as long as both teams were making plays. You know, there's kind of always been this sort of favorability towards who makes the most stylistic sort of highlight. And I think that that even extends into other areas of Ultimate. I mean, you look at how the Callahan Award in college is handed out, you know, the Heisman of that respective division. It's often driven by who makes the coolest highlight video that gets put up on YouTube. I feel like that kind of aesthetic treatment of awards, of MVPs, has always been a very central part of Ultimate. And so I'm inclined to do some of that when I look back and do like retroactive analysis. And yet, I think that I too lean a little bit more towards the modern thrower, like 2022 Ozgar, where he had a damn near 98% completion rating and would have had it for not like one bad game against a very good defense in DC in the playoffs. You know, it's just one of those things where I think that the precision to me does matter. I think that the lack of errors does matter. And especially in this kind of heightened era of skill level and in this modern chunk of time in this modern saga, I think that I do rank Babbitt pretty highly. Like, I do think, what would it look like if he were to go back and play for a 2015 AUDL team? You know, he came into the league in 2016 in part, made an immediate impact as that Blom Bomber version of himself for the Empire then, made a, you know, a buzzer beating grab to send a game into overtime against DC in his second appearance as a pro. He was filling up the stat. He had a 50 goal, almost 40 block season in 2017. His first full season with Ben Yacht. You know, like, there are sort of glimpses into what could have happened had Babbitt been dropped into pre-modern AUDL. And I think that the numbers would have been pretty astronomical, pretty NASA-like. And so I this is all a long-winded way of me trying to deflect from answer, much like you were doing. I think that Babbitt is actually a top three contender this year, or maybe top five, because I think one of the things that drags it down just a little bit for me is, again, that like standout performance in the second half of the season. I think he had really good games. I think that the road trip in week 12 at Colorado, at Salt Lake, he was very good and strong in his role for the Empire, but it wasn't like he was just taking over games. And I think back to like 2022 Ozgar, he took over a handful of games, including in championship weekend when he pivoted around his role, relied more on his receiving talents. I think back to 2019 Ben Yacht, who had his best game of the season in the championship game win against Dallas, where he had 10 plus scores, like 500 total yards and zero turnovers. I think about that stuff and I think those individual performances matter. And I do think that it hurts a little bit in the overall grand scheme, talking like legend sort of stuff, that Babbitt didn't have one of those past, you know, week seven, I would say, is probably the last truly like visibly dominant against a good opponent we saw Babbitt, you know, and against Atlanta, where he was just kind of going deep at will, skying out multiple defenders, had that pogo stick sky against Mike Kobira on a Ryan Ozgar jump ball, you know, these kind of moments. And I feel like there was obviously the Babbitt presence in the playoffs and everything, but it didn't quite have that big game thing. And I think the same thing happened to Will Kitchers back in 2015. You know, he was injured towards the back end of that season and couldn't quite get up for a championship weekend as much as he wanted to. He was hampered by a hamstring, was not playing at his top level. And so I don't know. I think this is all, again, a very long-winded way of saying, I think that this season was one of the more impressive because of, like you saying, it being so asymmetrical to the rest, that it didn't have that throwing feature. Yeah. There was this other, though, agreed upon dominance that we haven't seen like this before. We haven't seen a player just be able to go out, be the number one option. The other team knows they're the number one option, and the game is coming down to the crunch time, and there's just absolutely nothing you can do to stop Jeff Babbitt from getting open in the end zone.
Yeah, I mean, really, it's when it comes down to it, it's like Babbitt forced all of our hands into giving the MVP to a player that was not known for his throws, like was relatively singularly dimensional. Like that is the reason why he got MVP. And I think that does tell a lot about how impactful the season he had.
Yeah, I mean, I think to your point, it's like sometimes we make things so much more complex than they have to be. Like we think of these players having to have so much hybridization. You know, we talk about that all the time. Yeah. How much versatility can a player have? I think it's why so many people flock to picking Jack Williams as the best player in the world. It's his versatility. It's his balance. But, you know, like a lot of people like to ask, what do you mean by that? And I think we get kind of caught up in the weeds there, and it neglects sometimes just knowing who's powerful, knowing who's dominant, you know, a Babbitt level player, a Ben Yacht level player who can simply just change the context of how the game is played. I mean, you could see that in the Week 3 game with Babbitt, where DC was punching really well back and forth with big plays in the open field in the second half of that game. The Christian Boxley sky, the Thomas Edmonds play, like, these were big momentum fueling plays at the end of the game that got the DC crowd behind it. And yet New York just kept grinding it down into scoring position and then just rewarding Babbitt. It was just Babbitt time, just collecting checks and cashing them in at the bank. Like, I don't know that like simplicity again, it's like, it's so interesting. Cause I agree with you. I think that throwing is the most important component of this sport. And yet, he was simply so dominant, such a, like,
yeah, hammer. Well, and it's that fact that made it such a tough decision, because it was like going away from my instincts of giving it to, you know, a more versatile offensive player, right? But then, yeah, you just think to yourself, like, who is the most dominant force in the league this year? And it was probably Babbitt. So, yeah, I think leaving things as simple as that makes a lot of sense sometimes.
Well, speaking of things being simple, let's move to one of the more complex subjects, which is defense. And you and I have kind of individually been going over it, and there was a fair amount of discrepancy in the ballots between who should be the top defender. Antoine Davis, I think, very deservedly coming away with it, but there were some great other candidates, including the two first runner-ups in Lucas Ambrose and John Randolph, both having fantastic defensive seasons. There was just a litany of great defensive performances individually throughout the AUDL in 2023. It felt like a new era of defense starting to begin with all the new pulling rules and just the general, I think, sort of response to what we've been describing as that possession-based meta that's been infecting the sport, where now defenses are having a few years to get used to that kind of change of play and are developing strategies to sort of constrict the backfield, or I think gum up more lane spots earlier in drives. It really feels like there's a little bit more purchase in how defenses can leverage themselves against offensive units. And so, talking about the best individual defender, we don't have much in the way of stats at all. Nope. We have blocks. We have the ability to go in and kind of analyze who they might have been guarding in sort of an individual matchup sense. If you go back and look at some of the tape and compare it with some of the output data that an offensive player might have in a particular matchup, but it's a lot of alchemy and witchcraft kind of trying to determine who is actually playing good defense. And while, again, I absolutely think that the top three defenders and the overall all defense team lists are well constructed, I can't help but notice that a lot of it is predicated on overall block numbers. And I just kind of wanted to get into a little bit of a topic discussion with you on how exactly do we analyze defense right now, right? And we've talked about this extensively, particularly as it relates to Defensive Player of the Year, which is a little bit more all-encompassing than just direct coverage. You know, 2021, right, the first year that this award came into existence, AJ Merriman won it, and it was both for his coverage play, but it was also for his ability to activate so much of that counterattack for the Breeze D-line. And I think similarly held true in 2022 with Cody Spicer and his ability to not only play lockdown coverage defense in one-on-one matchups, but also become this very activated attacker whenever they would get a turnover and he could move into space both as a thrower, as a receiver, firing up, clanging the disc off of his head when he gets a score. 2023, Davis, I think, shows the first signs that we are getting a little bit beyond just tethering everything to overall block numbers. Spicer was that a little bit in 2022. Obviously, I don't think he finished in the top 15 in overall blocks for the year. I think he was top 20. I'd have to go back and look, but it wasn't like he was surging at the top of the blocks list.
That wasn't why he was in the conversation. Right.
Similarly with Antoine this year, you know, he's among the league leaders, but it's not like he's in the same realm as Ambrose or Burnett or even, you know, some of these rookie defenders. Wettengill, like, had a fantastic year for Indianapolis. But, you know, given the games, given that everyone's watching these things, I think there was no question in anyone's head by the end of the season who you would want in a potential matchup to shut down the opposing team's best player. And that was Antoine freaking Davis. Like, he was just unbelievable in the back half. And you talk kind of in converse with Babbitt, who had good games down the stretch of the season. Antoine had a series of great to freaking fantastic games to close out 2023. I mean, both games of championship weekend, he takes on Henke one game in the semifinal, and then the next day takes on Jordan Kerr, arguably the two hottest scores in the league heading into that event, and completely wipes them off of the map. In the East Division final, Christian Boxley was effective at times, but he certainly wasn't the player that we'd seen throughout 2023. And that was in large part because Davis was assigned to him at times in that game as well. You go back to the Week 12 matchups where he took out Kerr again in Salt Lake. And then the night prior in Colorado, he was given the business, downfield, definer, Frood, you name it. Antoine was in the area. It felt like we kind of turned a corner a bit in how we talk about these players and how we actually look at what they're doing on the field as defenders.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think Antoine, in his ability to limit those stars that you just mentioned, like that was what really propelled him. Because you were talking before about like aesthetic, like being a part of these individual awards. I guess you were talking about the MVP in particular, but defensively, aesthetically, it was Ambrose all season. Like, he had some of the most insane highlights I've ever seen. And I ultimately voted for him at the top of my Defensive Player of the Year ballot just because I have never witnessed a defensive display visually that he put on. But you're right. Like, when it came to one-on-one matchups, yeah, like, Ambrose got Kerr a couple times when they played Salt Lake. But generally, you know, the guys he was guarding still kind of got theirs, even though he would also get his. And like, I remember when they played Seattle, like, Ambrose made tons of good plays on Khalif, but then Khalif also put up like 10 scores in that game. So like, the ability Antoine showed to like really take a guy completely out of the game, and I think that's what we saw a lot with Spicer the year before as well. I agree with you. I think we've kind of evolved our expectations and kind of our definition of what it means to be a top level defender. But I do want to bring up the offensive ability. Obviously, Antoine has plenty of offensive ability. He's been like a fantastic O-line player for most of his career, but he wasn't really needed in that role this year with New York. He didn't really shine on the counterattack as much as he did last year. I'm still like internally, I'm still trying to weight the importance of ability after the turnover. And like, if we do group that in with top defender discussions and like, it deserves some weight. I'm still just kind of debating internally how much to give that. Because if you compare him to Ambrose there, I do think Ambrose was a little bit more important to LA's counterattack, like capping drives and kind of being that goal-scoring presence. Whereas Antoine, you know, and part of it is just the wealth of options that that New York D-line has to finish points, especially when Babbitt switches over. But yeah, go ahead. I'm curious to get your thoughts on that.
Oh, I was just going to add to your point, his own teammate, John Randolph, I feel like is the greater example of two-way yeah. instrument that really just is the emblem of what the entire D-line represents, and particularly for New York, setting the break rate record in 2023. It's kind of hard to exceed JR at certain points because not only is he guarding handler matchups, he's going downfield, getting pursuit blocks, getting help blocks right. downfield in deep space. And then he's their number one thrower a lot of times in the counterattack. And also, at times, spelling over in select instances on offensive possessions to convert breaks as both a thrower and receiver. He's yeah. a Callahan Award winner. There is no question as to the resume that John Randolph has. And yet, at times, I think people really forget about the kind of force that he brings to this Empire counter. And it starts with the fact that he makes a player like Antoine almost a little irrelevant sometimes in these transition right. looks because he can just run it himself. And he's yeah. got such a good, I think, feel for what situations call for what. That's Randolph, where at times he'll do his small ball dominator stuff where he just absolutely invades spaces almost on an atomic level and just destroys people footstep by footstep. But he's also now a little bit more, I think, green-lighted in how he approaches hucking in transition, taking a few more downfield looks, stretching and kind of putting his foot on the proverbial throat of an opponent when they have the opportunity to quick strike out of a turnover. I think he's mm-hmm. got a terrific sense for that. And it's just, again, to your point, that overall balance, like where does that leave it? Like not only are they able to get a turnover, but are they able to capitalize it? Because I think more and more you're seeing that kind of identity shift a little bit too, where there are these teams who can generate a lot of blocks, but maybe they don't always know what to do with them on the turn. I mean, Minnesota, right. for example, struggled with that for years. You go back and you look, the windshield led the league in blocks any number of times, and yet their defensive conversion efficiency was not great. And so it's hard to analyze some of their defenders in an overall sense of what they're providing if they get a block and immediately make a mistake in transition with a turnover. Whereas I think with the Empire, in particular with JR, what they do so well is convert those chances into high efficiency break conversions. And I think you see it in a lot of the playoff teams too, where there's just a more well-rounded approach. Again, as we're in this possession meta narrative of you really need yeah. to value all these opportunities. You can't just be leaving turnovers on the table. You can't just be leaving break chances on the table. And I think an operator like Randolph really epitomizes that. You know, not only can he provide coverage, he's going to be like an all AUDL level player for you in the transition game.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. You can maybe argue that Randolph as a whole on that D-line was the most versatile defender they had, or had the best season in terms of versatility, in terms of how he contributed on that D-line. But yeah, we give the Defensive Player of the Year award to Antoine. Maybe that's also because it's kind of like a Babbitt situation that we haven't had a Defensive Player of the Year winner that really was like just lockdown defender. And like I think it just got to the point where because of the big games against Henke and against Kerr at championship weekend, it's like, okay, you are just someone who can take away star players. Like he made it similar to how Babbitt made it, so we can't ignore that fact. And he kind of like willed himself in the second half of the year to win this award, so it makes sense, but it still just kind of creates this bigger conversation about what it means to be a top defensive player. How much offense does that or should that include? And I'm sure we're going to be continuing to figure these things out as the years go on as well.
We just need like a heat map or a shot chart or something. That's what I really want to start to get into. It's like, what happens when you throw this defender in like this quadrant of the field? I mean,
yeah.
I could have multiple pages of defensive stats and metrics and analytics I would love to be able to look at, but seems like we're
one day
than that. I know.
Yeah.
I know. We'll get there. We'll get there, buddy.
We'll get there. I know. We will.
Speaking of getting there, we've got so much else to talk about. So let's shift a little bit away from individual awards and start talking about some of these teams. And I'm just going to go through and bang out the first teams for the All-AUDL, All-Defense, and All-Rookie real quick-like. But we'll be able to get into some of the other teams, the second and third teams, in the All-AUDL rookie and defense as we kind of talk about more of these players. But if you're listening, you're going to want to go to the AUDL.com and again, check out the full list of honors from the season end award ballots. But getting into it, the All-AUDL first team going in alphabetical order, starting with who else but the 2023 MVP, Jeff Babbitt, followed by Brett Halsmeyer, Ben Yacht, Pavel Giannis, Jordan Kerr, Sean McDougal, and Ryan Asghar. Babbitt, Kerr, and Asghar are the three unanimous selections. A couple of notes from this team. Ben Yacht becoming a first-team All-AUDL member for the fifth straight season. That is a league record. No one else has really even come close to that kind of consistency on first-team ballots. Although, there is one other player who has a six-year All-AUDL overall mark in Pavel Giannis. He's made two second-team All-AUDLs in that stretch, but he gets back on the first team with his first season in LA alongside of his teammate Sean McDougal. In the All-Defensive category, again, starting alphabetically, Lucas Ambrose, Justin Burnett, Antoine Davis, Ben Yacht, John Randolph, Cody Spicer, and Joey Wiley. Ambrose, Burnett, Davis, and Randolph claiming unanimous selections for that All-Defense first team. Yacht, I believe, becoming the first player ever to make an All-AUDL first team as an offensive player as well as an All-Defensive team first team. So hats off to Yacht. Just another star bullet point on his legendary career resume. First 300 assists, first 300 goal player in AUDL history registered in 2023, the 5 times first team All-AUDL, 2-time straight champion, 3-time overall, 2-time reigning MVP. Again, we talked about this earlier, the GOAT resume for Yacht is starting to become almost undeniable in the way that a lot of these New York accolades are. Continuing to move on though, let's get to all rookie first team. Again, alphabetically starting with Lucas Ambrose, followed by Sam Berglund, Simon Carapella, Walker Frankenberg, Liam Haberfield, William Wettengale, and McKay Jorgensen. Ambrose, Berglund, and Frankenberg taking home unanimous selections from the all-rookie team. Daniel, is there any place in particular you want to start with other than kind of just the trepidation of these teams, or should we just get right into surprises slash snubs?
We can start with the all AUDL teams, I suppose. I mean, there were a lot of snubs at all the levels, because like I said before, this was by far the hardest time I've had creating these teams. I feel like the teams are always like, I don't know, I always want certain guys to be on, but then I just keep digging a little deeper into the stats or into their highlights or how good they were in big games, and then I keep shifting people around. But one guy in particular that I want to start with when it comes to snubs, And this is probably, we probably could have a whole episode on this conversation alone, is the Matt Smith season that we all just witnessed. This was, I want to get the number right, but I believe it was a 54, was it a 54-1 score to turnover ratio? Does that sound right? I'm looking it up right now.
Technically had 2 turnovers, but one was a drop from somebody else. He had 1 throwaway. And 2 incompletions, 0 drops.
Yeah. But
yeah.
So 54 scores, 1 throwaway. No one's ever come close to that ratio of scores to throwaways. Like, you can look back at like the highest scoring seasons, and the common theme is generally like those are higher touch volumes, or they're guys that like shoot the disc a lot, so they raise that assist total. And that comes with throwaways, but like this has never been done before. And like I said, it wasn't particularly close. I looked through all the history of high scoring seasons. I think someone might have been at like somewhere between like a 20 to 30 score to turnover ratio, but 54 is just otherworldly. And it was so in line with like Atlanta's growth this season. We were talking about we were talking about it a bit before recording, but the way that this Atlanta team has transformed or has evolved from just like the Huck heavy, you know, deep attack focused team that we've seen the past couple of years with Austin Taylor leading that charge to a lot more balanced and well-rounded and able to show that they can win close games by playing possession ball. They don't necessarily need to resort to the big plays all the time. Matt Smith is just like the key piece that just brings so much stability and balance to that offense. It's very easy to look at that offense and just like name star after star, but I think Matt Smith continuously gets overlooked, and maybe it's because he's just like been around so long and been playing at a high level for so long, we just take him for granted. But this was his best career year. I mean, he'll say the same thing. And I do think the fact that he only threw the disc away one time should be rewarded in terms of recognition. So I don't know how you feel, but he was on my third team all ADL. I just feel like I could not leave him off the ballot. It would never have sat right with me if I did.
I want to very loudly say that I agree with basically everything you are saying up through the decision of naming him to an all-AUDL team. I think it was one of the most impressive seasons. I think that it's kind of otherworldly, as you put it, as far as efficiency numbers for scores versus turnovers. There's simply nothing else in its category. And yet, it's one of those ways in which I feel like we are differing from earlier years in some of these selection processes where these aren't as statistically focused. We do have more areas to analyze these players. And I feel like the score to turnover ratio and some of the ways in which you can sort of wonderize the stats from there, some of the offensive efficiency numbers that he has individually are similarly out of this world impressive. I still think among the top 20 scorers all time, he is like a deviation above everyone else in terms of overall offensive efficiency. So this isn't even out of line necessarily with the rest of his career. So I think that's one of the complications too. Like, do you say it's almost just an improvement in the same way that he's been throughout most of his career, particularly with Atlanta, where he's just scoring and not making many mistakes that take things off of the table? It's what we expect out of him. And because this Atlanta offense has so many different pieces that they go through, just having an exceptional version of the season that he's been having for several now, I think makes it harder to differentiate what is the overall impactful value of what it's changing for Atlanta. Now, to your point, this is the first time that Atlanta has made a South Division Championship game since 2016 in just their second season as a franchise. It's been 7 years since then. You could definitely correlate a lot of that success with the lack of turnovers that Atlanta experienced this year as one of the top teams as far as turnovers per game. Last year, I believe they led the league in fewest turnovers per game. So this is kind of like in line with what they're trying to accomplish. And again, Smith is the emblem for all that. I just worry that too much of that boils down to these are nice numbers, as opposed to looking at kind of the holistic evaluation of what the Atlanta offense was, and that it was one of the most dangerous spread attacks who relied a lot on the throwing talents in the backfield of Austin Taylor, who I'd similarly describe as a snub on this year's all-AUDL ballot, potentially,
yeah,
depending on how you look at it, and Bobby Taylor and Christian Olsen and kind of the front that they present and the way in which they can spread it out everywhere. Again, this is to not take anything away from the season that Smith had. I completely agree with you. One of the most impressive efficiency seasons we have ever seen. And yet it just, I don't know. There just wasn't that, I guess, game that stood out in my head where it was like, here's Smith taking over. And I think that's cheap almost to evaluate it on that level. I mean, he had that greatest in the playoff game. He had numerous moments in the first matchups with Carolina where he was making statement goals in the first game against Austin when they won in the regular season convincingly against the Soul. Smith had a great performance. It's not to say that he wasn't there getting everything, but it wasn't like there was some, aha, this is the Matt Smith game that we've been waiting for that I think would kind of cement a selection like an all AUDL. I think that's kind of fair.
I get it. I'm just
saying it's Like, would you evaluate him as an all AUDL candidate if you didn't go to the stats tables and start compounding those numbers? I guess that,
well, right. Like, and I understand.
A step back.
I understand
not
that,
doing
that's the argument.
Kind of paper math stuff. Like, would you just kind of listing out players get to Matt Smith in the top 21? And to your point, I don't think many other people did. And again, that isn't to detract from the season that he had. Like, I want to keep screaming that from a mountaintop because he had a fantastic year. It's just, it's to what you said. It's so freaking hard that this is kind of one of those players that takes a casualty.
I get it. And yes, if you were just solely basing it on like what you see, even what you see from the Atlanta offense, you wouldn't necessarily point to Matt Smith and be like, oh, like this guy is for sure on an all AUDL team or should be considered among, you know, the top 20 seasons in the league. But there is a point where like the stats jump off the page so much that like I think we have to give sufficient weight to it, or at least I do as a stats guy.
So of course the dude with the lowest turnover and highest score ratio is just gonna light up all the bells in your head. Like,
yeah, but it was like, I mean, that's, you could argue Babbitt had a similarly efficient season and just like getting the job done, scoring goals, not turning the disc over. Of course he had the aesthetic element of it and was flashy at times, but like second half of the season, Jeff Babbitt and Matt Smith, like kind of comparable seasons or periods, if you want to call them that. So I just think the stats do, obviously you can't weight all of the choices entirely on stats, but when they're that much of an outlier in terms of league history, to me, like he's the perfect candidate for why we introduced a third team all AUDL, because like I think that season deserves some recognition and this seemed like the way to do it.
Yeah, but now you're talking about crowning or honoring people based off of almost solely stats. And if we start to plow back
but
and kind of
solely stats.
I know.
Turnovers. Turnovers directly correlate with winning. Like that is the stat.
Solomon Ruschmeyer Bailey and Matt Kuchohannes have personal like listed spots on all of these teams every year. Because if we're just gonna boil it down to that, then those two deserve to be on every all AUDL team. Andrew Roy too.
I would say the scoring numbers aren't there for those other guys. Like this was incredibly rare to have a 50 plus score season with that few turnovers. Usually they kind of correlate with each other, right? Like if you have a super low turnover player, it means they're not being that aggressive. They're not really scoring that much, but that was not at all the case with Matt Smith.
It's not that scores aren't important. I just feel like at times we might overvalue that particular discrete number when it's the result of kind of a team efficiency. Again, it's scores, assists, goals, like all of those, even blocks kind of are to me the RBIs of our sport. They're nice. They tell you things, but it is so far away from like a full descriptor. And again, to your point of that Matt Smith had more scores, for the particular punctuating point of the goal or the assist, but if we factor in hockey assists, which more and more people I think are really starting to come around to as an indicator of just like efficacy, particularly in initiating a scoring sequence, you throw in like Andrew Roy and that number starts to become a lot more equal with a Matt Smith. And when you look at kind of the volume of a Roy or a Ruschmeyer Bailey or somebody kind of in that stratosphere of 40, 50 plus touches and completions a game, you factor in like a hockey assist or kind of a setup. I don't know. And then the other thing that I think of too is that now with so much of pulling becoming a strategic weapon in this league, how much more valuable is it those throwers who pick up the first disc out of some of these trap rolling line, back line pulls that are being initiated against offenses? How much more of a worth is it for like an Andrew Roy to be completing passes off of the back line? I'm getting way off into the weeds, so I gotta be careful here. All I'm trying to say is that I think that statistical analysis can be really tricky with particularly scores, because again, it encapsulates, I think, an offense's production as a total. Like the fact that it is an individual, I think, is more a component of the team itself rather than this person is so good at getting scores. It's kind of like in a feel approach way. Like there are certain players and stat lines where it's like, yeah, that totally makes sense. And then there are other ones where it's like, that seems like it's a lot of filler. And I'm definitely not classifying Matt Smith as filler, but it's just really hard to, I think, suss out what the overall, I think, worth of some of those scoring totals are, you know, like, or comparing the ratio. But again, I'm getting way off into the weeds here, so I wanna stop.
Sure, we can move on from Matt Smith, but I think it warranted a discussion at the very least. Who's a guy that sticks out to you as like a notable snub from the all UDL teams?
I mean, I think Matt Smith is on that list. You know, Austin Taylor as well, Draco. I think, you know, we talk about what happened in the second half of that playoff game against Austin. Taylor had potentially the game-clinching half-field hammer assist near the end of regulation in that one. And if he completes that, I think we have a radically different take on what his season looked like, because he once again was a league leader in huck completions. He's the only player in league history to be completing the number of hucks he is at the percentage he's doing it at. Ryan Osgar has exceeded him in overall hucking percentage, but in three straight seasons, Draco is completing above like 73% of his hucks. There is no more efficient and effective long thrower than Draco right now in this league over the past three seasons. And I just feel like the changes that we talked about as far as Atlanta adapting from the long ball, so much of that gets back to Draco being so malleable and how he approaches. You know, last year we talked about them moving him out of the backfield at times and allowing his quickness to set a stack and to get like an activating, initiating cut out of a stack or to come out of the upfield alignment and come back into the handler lane. Like he's been, I think, at the forefront of sort of adapting and readapting to what Benson Jaja has brought into the fold as far as how Atlanta wants to attack. And so I think he deserves a whole bunch of attention. I mean, we talk about just aesthetic and kind of emblem performances for a team that went far. Brian Vanoka, I mean, B-Von went off in the semifinal in a way in which no one believed, I think, on a league level other than people outside of Minnesota he was capable of. I think people, you know, he's a 2019 All-Star. He's been this kind of captain and figurehead leader for a Winchell team, but that has always fallen a little bit short of its aspirations. And I think that semifinal game really kind of put him back on the pedestal that he deserves to be on, where it's like, you don't want to challenge that man in space. You just don't. And he has another one of those stat lines and just overall performances from this year where you can go back to almost any game and finding him making a different version of a highlight. It can be one of those robo gadget flick hucks that he has. It can be the two skies in the semifinal game. It can be a backbreaking Callahan score against a rival from Madison in the middle of the season. It's kind of like whenever they need B-Von to fulfill a role, he's there. And I just think given his career high completion rating and everything else that he accomplished this season, it felt odd for him to not make one of these teams. Lucas Ambrose, who basically swept Rookie of the Year, was runner up and Defensive Player of the Year. Mm-hmm. Not being honored at all for that, I found strange. I had him on, I believe, second team or third team All-AUDL, but other voters felt differently. I thought that the punch he provided on the counterattack to what you were talking earlier was really worthwhile. And another name, last year's Defensive Player of the Year, he makes first team all defense, but Cody Spicer. I mean, I know the stats weren't necessarily there this year, but he was one of those players being tasked with kind of switching back from offense and defense depending on the particular game in the middle of the season as they dealt with Nethercutt absences and just all the injuries that the Summit experienced in 2023. It felt like at the end of each day or each game, though, it was still Cody Spicer is one of the three players you have to worry about the most when matching up with Colorado, who, despite finishing 8-4 during the regular season and getting knocked out in the first round, I still think of as one of the, you know, six best teams in this league. I think they just had a rocky year with injuries and everything else to their lineups. But, I mean, Cody Spicer is a dog. And I think if anyone were to start selecting teams in kind of a fantasy draft, it would be hard to imagine him falling out of the top 20. But, you know, kind of the counterpoint to you talking about all these statistically excellent seasons, for as much as you watch game film or consider him to be the star level person, you go and you look at Spicer's stats from this year, and it's a little bit of a down year compared to what he had last year. So we'll see.
Yeah. Well, and then I think there is also an element, whether spoken or unspoken, of team success, right? Like Colorado fell well short of expectations this year. So it just, like, if they had won their playoff game or even made a championship weekend, I do think, I mean, part of it might have been because Spicer was, like, notably good in those games and, you know, more games, more sample size, more opportunities for him to really shine and jump off the page. But yeah, like with Colorado, I just felt like I'd have to look at last year's awards, but I think it was a lot easier to give their players awards and selections for these teams last year because they were so impressive. But yeah, it's always going to be a tough task when teams underperform, even if the individual players themselves really aren't any worse than they were the season prior, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Atlanta, yeah, probably fell into some of that too. Like with Draco, like you said, if they had won that playoff game, I think Draco for sure would have been on one of these teams.
I mean, we've talked about this before in terms of game results and stuff, and there really almost should be more of a running log as to what would just happen if you flip this goal here, this game result there, and one goal scenarios. Because I feel like we extend that courtesy so much to individual team performances, but that boils down to some of these players too. I mean, Draco is a classic example. I think Bevon too. If Minnesota pulls out that game and they make a championship appearance, right, maybe it's Bevon taking a spot over, like, say, Jacob Miller on third team all AUDL. Not to take away anything from Miller. Obviously, he had a fantastic year. Fantastic. But I'm just saying, in the perceptions of the minds of the voters, you know, you and I were just 2 of 8 this year. It might have made a little bit of a difference, because I do think, to your point, that so much of this is kind of constructed on what do these stats mean in terms of the success? Because you could go really deep as far as just individual impressive statistical seasons in the league in 2023. Yeah. But if you kind of look at how these teams have formatted, it's very much the kind of winners getting those spoils, and not so much a player like, say, Alec Wilson-Holiday, who had one of the more impressive receiving seasons in the league this year and was a most improved candidate. Who else? Duncan Fitzgerald, too. You know, I think that's another candidate. You go back and you match up some of his stats, his just raw volume totals, and compare it to, say, somebody from 2016. He would come out super favorably, you know. He had 70-plus total scores, 500 odd completions, you know, was a key piece of a semifinalist. Like, but it skews out, I think, a little bit differently nowadays, depending on kind of how your team finishes and what those efficiency numbers look like.
Right. Here's kind of a broad question about these all AUDL teams. Do you feel like the way the league is going and the way our sport is going into more generally possession ball type approaches to offense, like, is it because it's harder to stand out as individuals, where, like, there's just less clear-cut stars on all these teams that are making these final end-of-year selections so difficult? Or do you think it's something else? Do you think it's like, kind of a rising of talent and a rising of stars, or maybe just us needing to redefine, like, what a star is in our league? Does that make sense?
Yeah. I think it's both and. Like, I think there's obviously the overall skill development. We are still a sport that is so much in the nascent stages of its development. As we keep talking about with these various rookie classes over the last several years, you just see a visible improvement from the newer players coming in and their ability to step into major roles. I mean, you talk about Lucas Ambrose being a major cog in a playoffs team's push towards the West Division finale. You talk about Walker Frankenberg. He was fantastic all year leading that Spiders attack and was crucial to them in the clutch numerous times in his first season as a pro. And I think there is an overall raising of just ability. And with that, I think you see more spread tactics and more versatility in how you employ stars. You see more, as we're seeing, kind of two-way play. Maybe having somebody on offense for a particular matchup in a given game and then switching them over depending on the favorabilities of the factors you see and then potentially shutting someone down. I know for a fact that Babbitt started the championship game because they wanted to do a show of force on defense and leave him out there as kind of an intimidation factor. And again, it gets back to that point of kind of the untalked about, the non-numerical value of some of these players. And I think you are seeing more of that. I think you are seeing coaches in general loosen up a little bit some of the rigidity of, this is an offensive player and this is a defensive player. I think you're seeing a little less specialization. And with that, you're seeing more distribution. I think the number one team that always comes to mind for that with me, at least offensively, is DC, where you see almost these five, six, seven thrower lineups. Sure, they have Andrew Roy in the backfield, but like, you even talk about the evolution of Johnny Malks, who became such more of a downfield playmaker this year. You just see more and more players, I think, loosening up into what they are in a particular range on the field. And so I think as you see players become more comfortable in various spaces on the field, you will see more versatility and less of a reliance, like you're saying, on stars, on kind of this individual who we go to, who we know is going to score. That's kind of like from the heyday of my college experience in the mid aughts, you know, like that. I grew up on kind of the Bo Kittredge hero ball, where a lot of these teams were sort of fundamentally constructed on two throwers and two to three downfield options, and then players who understand it and complemented that action really well. That game is dying. And I think, thankfully, I think there's components of it, but there's way more just, I think, attackers you have to be aware of in any given position on the field than there ever were before. And I think you're even seeing that with New York's offense. They continue to expand roles a little bit in every dimension. You see more Elliot Chartok going downfield. You see John Lithgow becoming more of a thrower. You see that, you know, this nebulous term that we keep using, this balance that we talk about, where there's sort of an interchangeability of all these parts. I think as you see that, you're going to see, maybe a lessening of the production quality of stars, right? Like, I don't...
Sure.
And maybe this gets back, and maybe this is a nice way to tie it up with Babbitt, where it's like, you know, there is more to his game than just simply, well, he's got two assists and only 60-odd scores. That doesn't even clock in the top, you know, 20 of the entire league. But it's like, it's Babbitt. Wherever you play him, it's going to be an added bonus to your lineup, no matter what. Like, he's an MVP in any role you put him in.
Right. I was thinking about New York in general, like, because DC is a classic example of this balanced approach. Carolina was kind of, they kind of popularized it before with their 2021 championship, and how it was more like, just was it just Laviolette that made an all-AUDL team that year, despite having Fairfax and Fisher and Eric Taylor and all of them?
Anders Jungst.
Andrew Jungst, rookie of the year. Yeah. But with New York, like, I know we kind of push the narrative that they're like so star driven, but thinking more about it, like, it's not that they're so star driven all the time. It's really just like in those clutch late game situations, it's the same stars that are shining over and over again. So maybe there's just going to be more of an emphasis on those late game situations and just like who stands out in those moments, like we were just talking about with Draco. Like, if he does complete that throw, maybe it seems silly that would have vaulted him to an all-AUDL team. And, you know, that's a weird example because it was a Holzmeier drop. But whatever, like, same idea of, like, that. Those are the performances that are notably memorable and notably are, like, that is why your team won that game. It's because that player performed when the team needed them most. And I think we do still get that the most from New York. And then you compare it to a team like DC. I still have no idea what they do in those late game situations. So it is like, that makes it harder for those guys to separate themselves out, right? Like, I think that to me seems to be the differentiator in like modern day star power, I think, is just like who closes out these games. It's still why Jack Williams is considered the best in the world, I think, because of his resume with doing that for New York and Team USA and just like at all levels.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great point. I think that it's kind of finding the greatest utility for those stars, not necessarily the overall production. I feel like that overall production component. And again, it gets back into kind of pre-modern AUDL, where it was sort of this just raw numbers game. You just wanted somebody who got stats.
Yeah,
who got
30 seasons.
Yeah, and just like, you can play them anywhere and they're going to get you blocks and they can fill up the volume numbers and all this stuff. Like, I feel like so much of that is lessening. There's so much less of an importance on that, and it gets back to more of these team metrics and who can kind of advance them the most. You know, who can be that kind of fulcrum piece that isn't turning it over. And then this is now a huge can of worms for opening up to your Matt Smith pick for all AUTR. I feel like it supports that. Yeah, I mean, it'll be interesting to watch evolve. And I love that you bring up Carolina as an offensive concept and kind of their spread attack, because Bryce Merrill and Salt Lake have referenced numerous times this year that that has been their template for their development as the number one most efficient offense in the league, that they use that kind of interchangeability. And to your exact point, that is what made them so much more successful last year, even though they were the second runner-up in the West in 2022. They got away from the sort of heliocentrism of everything needs to run through Jordan Kerr to Jordan Kerr is obviously our still best player, and yet we're going to balance him out with six other players who can score kind of at will. And you see these phenomenal seasons from Jacob Miller, from Sean Knoll, from the entire offense, right? Dunabile, McKay Jorgensen, I know him, Luke Jorgensen. Just keep naming Jorgensens and throw like
a couple names. It's all of the Jorgensens.
Just Jorgensens all the way down. There was that one great shred reel midway through the season where they just had the entire locker room put on Jorgensen jerseys and then walk out together.
I do remember that. Yeah. Deserves
like Lindley and LaRue and a couple other those dudes just walking out in Jorgensen jerseys. They should just do Jorgensen night as like fan promotion. Everyone
gotta
just
lean into
wears a Jorgensen. Yeah. No, but you know, getting back to point, I think that you are seeing so much more of kind of that visible adaptation, that a visible adoption of exactly what you're saying, that you spread more, you distribute more, and you get more of these results. It is so much going away from who is this clear star, who is your clear leader of a team. Like you say, it's a narrative we like to talk about. I don't know if I'll say push. I'm not pushing anything.
Push makes it sound like we're like the puppeteers, like pushing.
No,
I just mean like we talk about it.
Microphone. I'm in my mid-30s and have a podcast, bro. I can't push anything.
We're not pushing. We're merely bringing to light certain ideas.
I am discussing. All I can do is discuss.
Discussing is a better word. Yes. But yeah, no, I think the star, kind of the star debate and what like a modern star is compared to the early year stars is going to be just like constantly evolving. And I'm excited to see how it continues to change. Cause it's like, we can't look at DC and be like, they have no stars. Like, it's just not true, but they don't have what New York has. Like, I think we can say that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, they have a lot. They have a lot, you know,
they do have a lot.
Second team, and they have a whole list of, I feel like, snubs too. We didn't mention them, but Tyler Monroe had a fantastic year. Thomas Edman.
That's the problem with them. Yeah, they're all snubs.
Shuffle, man. That's another one. Like, he played both ways. He basically did everything that they required him to. He had like a 98% completion rating. He had highlights. I just feel like he lacked like a game. Again, it was almost sort of like a Matt Smith storyline for him, where you look at the front to back consistency and how he performed. It's kind of unquestionable, and yet there wasn't that one moment in a New York matchup, in a matchup with Philly, where it felt like, okay, he's kind of like moved above Timon and Boxley and Roy and all these other pieces. It just felt so crowded. But that's just my take. You know, again, I feel like he might have been a snub. He split points between O-line and D-line and still had like 3+ scores a game and like 20+ touches, like just phenomenal season for Edmonds in his first year at DC. And yet nowhere on this list, nowhere on any of these teams. It really goes
hard. He did, never mind. He may or may not have won a DC Breeze team award, but I'm not going to spoil that before the award's out. Cause why would I? But I have a feeling he might get some recognition this offseason. We'll leave it at that.
A strong premonition, perhaps.
Yeah, something tells me.
Well, again, that'll wrap it up for our discussion of the end of season ballots and awards. I'm sure we're going to talk more and more about this as we extend into the offseason. Thank you for being patient as we took a brief break after the end of the season. But we will be back with you at least once a week, every week going forward throughout the offseason. We'll put a slight asterisk for potential holiday weekends, sickness, travel, whatever. We have an offseason too. But We will be back here on Swing Pass with you to discuss news and notes and other things from around the AUDL as we work towards 2024. And I'm sure we'll have some predictions for end of season ballots for that season as well in the coming weeks. But we hope to join you soon. Sooner than later, we'll be signing off for now. Bye.